First case today is Federal Trade Commission versus AbbVie et al. Mr. Hoffman?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Matthew Hoffman for the FTC. There are a lot of issues in this case, so I'd like to reserve 15 minutes to respond to AbbVie's arguments and spend just 5 minutes focusing on the reasons why the district court erred in dismissing the FTC's reverse payment claim, if that's okay with the court.
We're really liberal with counsel's allocation, but this is unprecedented in my brief 13 years on the court. How about if I give you seven? 13 and seven.
Okay. 13 and seven? Okay. That's fine. I just want to make sure I have time to respond to what Mr. Waxman's going to say.
I have a feeling we're going to go into extra innings here anyway.
Okay, that's fine.
Before you start on the merits, I want to give everyone a heads up. The panel's interested in hearing your thoughts about our jurisdiction to hear this case. Mm-hmm. I know that's not an issue that either side briefed much, but, you know, the question is whether any of the claims fall within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Federal Circuit.
Yeah, and I think the answer to that is no. Claims fall under the jurisdiction of the Federal Circuit if they are arising under patent law. And this is an antitrust case, although there are patent elements to it. The court dealt with a very similar issue in the Lipitor case, mm-hmm. where there was also patent-related claims in the context of an antitrust case, and there the court...
I don't think anyone's concerned about the reverse payment claim, but we're interested in the sham litigation.
Yeah, there were also other antitrust claims in Lipitor that involved patent elements.
And wasn't that the reasoning of Lipitor? Wasn't Lipitor saying this does not go to the Federal Circuit's jurisdiction because there's reverse payment claims and because the presence of those reverse payment claims allow the same relief, therefore the need to address patent law claims is non-existent, therefore we retain jurisdiction?
I'm not sure that that's precisely what Lipitor said, but I certainly would agree with that certainly there is jurisdiction over this case by virtue of the reverse payment claims, but there is also jurisdiction independently over the sham litigation claims.
Well, doesn't sham litigation really take us right into patent law? Answer that.
So sham litigation in this case does involve issues of patent law, but that's not enough to make something arise under the patent laws.
Don't we have to determine whether litigation based on a patent was objectively or subjectively reasonable? And in order to determine whether litigation, patent infringement litigation, is objectively or subjectively unreasonable or reasonable, don't we have to get into the scope of that patent, maybe the patent prosecution history, perhaps even the tangential relation exception to patent law? All of that seems to be in the heartland of what the Federal Circuit does, and it seems that there would be very little left of the exclusive jurisdiction prong of 28 U.S.C. 1295A if we were doing that instead of the Federal Circuit.
Okay. Well, so 2 points. First of all, I think if the court has concerns about this issue, which I understand that it does, since the parties haven't briefed it, I think it would be appropriate to have supplemental briefing on this issue. But second, in response to your question, the Supreme Court dealt with a very similar issue in the Gunn versus Mitten case about 4 or 5 years ago.
Which that was involved, invalidity of patent, right?
That involved a patent malpractice, a claim involving malpractice in the prosecution of a patent or litigation of a patent.
It didn't require determining whether litigation subsequent to the patent was objectively or subjectively reasonable, did it?
It involved, because it was a malpractice case, it involved a case within a case that is involved proving the merits of a patent case. And the Supreme Court said that that's not enough to make it arise under federal law. So I think that principle applies here, and I think the court's reasoning in Lipitor also applies here. But as I said, I think that if the court has concerns about this, it really ought to be briefed by the parties, because we all have been in agreement so far that this is a case that properly belongs here. So with that in mind, let me turn to the reverse payment claim. The FTC's complaint clearly states a claim for reverse payment and trust violation under this court's decision in Activists. I'm sorry, the Supreme Court's decision in Activists and this court's decisions in King Drug and Lipitor. And those allegations are set forth in detail in the complaint, starting at paragraphs 112 to 132 primarily, which you can find at page JA4442. But briefly, the complaint alleges that Teva agreed to stay out of the androgel market for 3 years in exchange for AbbVie's agreement to confer a benefit on Teva worth $175 million in the form of the Tricor supply agreement. The Tricor agreement made no independent business sense for AbbVie, but it made perfect sense as an inducement to get Teva to delay its entry into the androgel market. AbbVie gave up $100 million in Tricor revenue, but it protected more than $1 billion a year in androgel revenue by keeping competitors out of that market through the end of 2014. Under Lipitor and King Drug, all the FTC needed to do was to allege a large and unjustified reverse payment, and the FTC's allegations here easily meet that standard. District Court, I think, made two basic mistakes here. First, it failed to accept the allegations of the complaint as true, as it was required to do on a motion to dismiss. And second, it improperly tried to assess whether there was a pro-competitive justification for the agreements, which Lipitor makes clear is not properly part of the motion to dismiss inquiry.
And as I understand it, Mr. Hoffman, the seminal allegation that the district court did not take cognizance of, in your view, is that these two agreements need to be considered as an integrated whole or part and parcel of the same deal rather than looking at each individually as pro-competitive. Right?
Yes, that's one of it. I would say that the district court also did not accept that the Tricor deal operated as a large payment to Teva, which is alleged in the complaint paragraph 119. Notably, if you look through the district court's decision, I don't think it ever mentions our allegation that the Tricor deal was a benefit to Teva worth $175 million. So those two things, which are really part of the same issue, I would say, is that the court didn't accept that this was all one reverse payment scheme in which the Tricor agreement was the inducement for the Androgel settlement.
Now, it may turn out if the reverse payment claim wasn't dismissed, that on discovery, maybe it turned, if you were allowed discovery on this, you might learn that, no, they were truly the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. But as you've alleged it, you say that, no, that both hands were... we're working in coordination, and you're saying that based on the plausibility standard, you should be given a shot.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We should be given a chance to take discovery on this and to present evidence on it, and we weren't given that chance in this trial. And so that's one of the court's major errors here. I think the court got hung up on the fact that that under the Tricor agreement, Teva is paying AbbVie for the supply of Tricor. Of course, the court addressed very similar allegations in Lipitor, and it made clear that the fact that some money flows from the defendant to the plaintiff doesn't mean that the overall scheme isn't a reverse payment. I think what the court said is, you know, if parties could include, first of all, in Lipitor, in one case, the defendant paid $1 million as part of a settlement of something that was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And in the Effexor part of that, the defendant agreed to pay royalties on Effexor. So there was money flowing from the defendant to the plaintiff, but the court still said that overall there was no adverse payment scheme alleged. And as Lipitor said, obviously if that wasn't the rule, then you could always insulate any agreement from review just by including some payment, some token payment in the...
What if it's not I understand your argument about the district court ignored the two agreements and all that, but to the point you were just making now, how do we differentiate between a token agreement, what's arguably a win-win settlement for both sides, and an anti-competitive reverse payment settlement agreement?
Right. I think the answer is that it's not that. That's really going to whether there's a the deals are pro-competitive in the final analysis, which Lipitor in particular makes clear is not properly part of the inquiry on a motion to dismiss. All you need to allege is that the payment was large, and obviously $175 million I think is large by any standard, and that it was unjustified. And here it's unjustified both because it doesn't reflect anything like the saved litigation costs. I mean, litigation's expensive, but not that expensive. It also doesn't, there's no independent explanation for why AbbVie would want to accelerate competition on Tricor other than to protect Androgel from competition. And so, again, those allegations that it's largely unjustified, that's enough to state a claim under the prevailing case law. On the question of whether it's pro-competitive or not, again, I think, you know, the court makes very clear that that's not properly part of the inquiry. You know, and I think that the court got confused there, too. I mean, it starts by saying that, well, it starts by analyzing the agreement separately, which was not proper in the first place. And then it says, well, the Androgel settlement allowed Teva to get into the market earlier than it otherwise, before patent expiration. So that looks like it was pro-competitive. But that's the scope of the patent test, which the court rejected in Activists. And then it looks at and says, well, there was this, there was also early entry in the Tricor market. But, the court addressed very similar situations in Lipitor and King Drug. I'm quoting from Lipitor now, but the court said, we specifically rejected GSK and Teva's argument that the reverse payment was justified. This is Lipitor referring to King Drug. We specifically rejected the argument that the reverse payment was justified because Teva was given permission to enter a different pharmaceutical market early. In the King Drug case, what he's referring to is Teva was allowed to enter the chewables market 37 months before patent expiration, which was something that was worth about $50 million. But the reverse payment related to the tablet market, which was orders of magnitude smaller, sorry, the $50 million was orders of magnitude smaller than the alleged $2 billion market the agreement was to have protected. So, to sum up, the complaint here alleged a reverse payment that was large and unjustified, and the FTC didn't need to do anything more to state a claim.
It's really a pleading case from your standpoint.
Yeah, it's really a pleading case from our standpoint.
There was summary judgment.
If there were summary judgment.
Reasoning going on by the district court at the Rule 12 stage.
Sure, if there were summary judgment, you would need to assess whether this agreement was actually pro-competitive. And there would be a lot more evidence. There might be experts. There might be a whole lot of things that the court could take into consideration at summary judgment or at trial. But this was just a motion to dismiss. Just like the situations in activists, King Drug, and Lipitor, I think the district court judge was just sort of a little too aggressive.
What about your claim that the court erred in denying injunctive relief? What do you have to show that, or what did you prove that AbbVie and Baisong's anti-competitive conduct is likely to occur?
In terms of the sham litigation?
Yes.
Okay. On the sham litigation, there are a number of factors that courts look at to determine whether conduct is likely to recur, and they focus on whether the wrongdoing was intentional. The district court here found that it was. Whether the violations were repeated. Here we have two sham litigations and evidence that AbbVie has previously made. Certainly, frivolous arguments that the court found were beyond the pale, a district court found in a previous case, whether there's been an acknowledgement of wrongdoing, which we don't have here. And I think most importantly, the nature of the business that they're in. I mean, AbbVie is a company, it's a large...
That's what I was getting at. It seems like your view is, hey, these are repeat players, they do this stuff all the time, trust us, and join them. Ad infinitum. I mean, it seems almost like a nature of the business bar going forward. It seems kind of extraordinary.
I don't think it's extraordinary. I think it's something that courts look at in the SEC context and in the FTC context.
Well,
it certainly may be that the district court could say, well, that's not enough for me to issue an injunction here. But the question here is, did the district court consider all the factors it was supposed to consider? And that's certainly a factor, nature of their business.
What injunction do you want? Just as I read the briefing, I think there was this notion of that each party mischaracterizes the precise bounds of the injunction. I guess one side makes it sound bigger because bigger injunctions are harder to get. It sounds like you are saying it's not that big because smaller injunctions, generally speaking, might be easier to get. Why don't you just lay out very clearly what injunction you think should have, the scope of the injunction that you want, that you think, sure, it, that you think is justified by the record that you provide?
Sure. So we ask for three things. One is a certification requirement for AbbVie's executives to certify that they, when they file Hatch-Waxman litigation, that that they reviewed it and it's not objectively baseless.
For how long?
I think that would be in the discretion of district court. I mean, it could.
But how long do you want?
I'm not sure that I.
Because you're the requesting, you're the party wanting relief. Do you want it for 36 months, 120 months, 360 months?
You know, often these injunctions run for a long period of time, but it might be only appropriate to have 5 years or so here. I think it really needs to be addressed on the circumstances of the case. But this certification requirement, let me say why it's important here. You know, one of the things that we encountered in this case was the somewhat unusual claim that that all of the, you know, all of the decisions to bring suit were just made by the lawyers at AbbVie with no input from the business people. I find that to be, we haven't challenged that finding, of course, but I find it to be unusual. And I think it's important that if you're filing a Hatch-Waxman lawsuit, that a business person at the company take responsibility for ensuring that this is not a frivolous sham lawsuit.
Well, why isn't that best addressed by lawyers who are members of the bar, officers of the court, who have their own obligation, their legal training, to make that assessment, as opposed to, for instance, maybe a member of the executive board or the business component of a company who may think to themselves, aha, 30 months without competition, that helps the bottom line. It strikes me that if we're going to do almost a legal process analysis, the best people to make this decision are those with legal training as opposed to those without.
I would say lawyers, I mean, obviously, we're all lawyers, and we know a lot about these sorts of things, but ultimately lawyers work for clients, and the clients are the ones who need to make the decisions based on the advice of
litigation. Litigation decisions assessing the reasonableness of litigation should be made by business people, not solely by lawyers.
Yes. Lawyers typically do not have the authority to go and file lawsuits without the approval of their clients. That's not something lawyers typically do. And part of the problem that we run into here, of course, is that what AbbVie did in this case, they said, well, the lawyers made the decision, and of course, you can ask why the lawyers made the decision, because that's privileged. So, you know, to the extent that this is all held within the legal department, that makes it very difficult to assess for an outsider whether this was filed for a proper purpose or for an improper purpose. So that's why the certification requirement is appropriate. We've also,
before you give us your second and third elements of the injunction, mm-hmm, after the certification requirement, I want to just make sure I understand, is this within the context of AmbroGel or just any potential lawsuit?
This would be any potential lawsuit. We think that, you know, given the history of sham litigation in this case and the nature
it's really
of
a bad
business,
it's a bad boy injunction. Really? A lot of these companies that do the branded drugs, they are pretty big and broad, right? You're going to shut them down in every business line they're in, not just AndroGel or TTRP?
Well, so we're not
TTRP.
Shutting down, we're not proposing to shut down any business lines. We're not proposing to stop anyone from filing any litigation that's appropriate. There are, you know, large pharmaceutical companies out there that do not file sham litigation.
So the injunction's not against filing litigation generally, it's against filing sham litigation?
The only things that we seek to address in the injunction are objectively baseless litigation. There's nothing that restricts you from filing lawsuits, you know, that have a good faith
okay.
basis.
So you want an injunction prohibiting them from filing the kinds of litigation they're not supposed to file anyway?
Correct. Okay. We want an injunction that prohibits them from filing objectively baseless litigation, given their history of doing that.
What are the second and third elements?
So the second element relates to filing litigation under this specific patent, and I'm just going to bracket that one because the patent does expire in 2020. So that's probably not something that we would seek on remand.
Right.
The third is an injunction against filing objectively baseless lawsuits in Hatch-Waxman cases. So, I mean, that's a broader prohibition than simply the certification requirement. You know, we think it's justified here. But again, this is all stuff that really should be addressed by the district court in the first instance. And the problem here is the district court didn't really apply the proper test and didn't seem to be characterizing what we were asking for correctly. So, you know, I understand, Judge Hardiman, your concerns about sort of a bad boy injunction, but I think those are concerns that really should be addressed by the district court under the proper standard in this case. If there's no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
There probably are more questions.
I'm happy to address more questions, okay. Of course.
Right. Well, I'm sure we'll have you up there on rebuttal for a while.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure Mr. Waxman will have lots of stuff to say on many different issues. And
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hoff.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Seth Waxman. I represent the AbbVie parties here, but all of the issues in the case, with the exception of two issues that are specific to Bassan's, I will be, as my letter to the court indicated, I'll be presenting oral argument. Mr. Hoffman has advised me he doesn't intend affirmatively to bring up the Bassan's issues, but if the court has questions about Bassan's, Mr. Neppel is here, and I would ask leave to cede some of my time to allow him to answer the court's questions. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal on my cross appeal, if I may.
That's fine. You filed a cross appeal. So.
In fact, on the issue of the cross appeal and the appeal, I'd like to say that before I'm going to respond almost immediately to my colleague's discussion of the reverse payments claim and try and answer some of the court's questions. But I do want to underscore at the outset of my argument that we think that the dispositive issues in this case, the dispositive errors, were the district court's finding of sham litigation and the district court's imposition of an unlawful disgorgement award. If this court were to hold, as we think it should, that AbbVie and Bassan's committed no antitrust violation and that the FTC was entitled to no remedy, that would very largely obviate the FTC's appeal. And so I do hope to be able to focus some of my time today mainly on those points, that the infringement suits were not shams, that the FTC failed to prove monopoly power, and that the disgorgement order was in any event unlawful. But first, let me address the reverse payments.
Do you have anything to offer on, I'm going to ask for supplemental briefing, but do you have anything to offer on the jurisdictional question before you get into that?
So we actually thought long and hard about this because not only does this case involve some consideration of a patent law issue, but this is like the mother of all patent law issues. This is whether there's an exception to an exception to an exception to a requirement that the Patent Act provides. But our view is that the court is not actually being called upon to decide who is right, that is, whether or not there was infringement under the doctrine of equivalence, but whether or not no reasonable party could have thought there was any chance of success. And in fact, the entities that brought the lawsuit acted with scienter, that is subjective baselessness. And
but to
those, we will
evaluate that. You have to. It requires some examination of the underlying patents, and as you say, it's a pretty deep evaluation of those patents. We get to equivalence. After equivalence, then we're off to patent prosecution history. After patent prosecution history, then we're off to tangential relation exception. All of those have to be evaluated and assessed to determine both the objective reasonableness and then, as you say, the scienter requirement. So it seems very, very hard to conduct those two analyses without first taking a tour through just about every step there is in patent law, not just for one case, but for two cases, one of which has a reverse payment component to it, which might make it different under Lipitor. But the second case, the Perrigo case, is distinct from Lipitor because there's no reverse payment companion there. And so it seems that in that case, if nothing else,
we are in for a long, long tour of patent law before we can get to the issues in this case. And that seems what 1295A is all about.
So I will say when I did a moot court for this oral argument, as soon as I got onto the objective baselessness, one of my moot court judges, Paul Clement, as it turns out, said, why are we being asked to decide all these patent cases? We're just going to certify this to the Federal Circuit. Why do we have to decide this? And my response was, I'm not aware that there's a certification process. And I think you are required to decide this. There was sham litigation at issue in the patent context in your decision in Wellbutrin and in Lipitor.
It's not certification.
Even only the cross appellants. I don't mean to sick this on you,
for purposes of your supplemental briefing, we know about Wellbutrin and Lipitor and so on. But I think what might distinguish this case is in those cases there were several theories packaged into a claim, some of which were patent, like sham litigation, some of which weren't, like sham citizen petition or reverse payment settlements. Here we have a standalone reverse payment claim, and we have a standalone sham litigation claim. And we have a well-pleaded complaint that's not just notice pleading, but it's fulsome, it's detailed, and it fairly raises all these patent issues, like in paragraph 78 through 100 of the complaint. So that's what we're focusing on.
And then the standalone paragraph, and it's not a certification process, it's an exclusive jurisdiction process. Certification is very different than exclusive jurisdiction. 1295A is not a certification statute. It's an exclusive jurisdiction statute.
I join with Mr. Hoffman in our determination to file a supplemental brief and let the court decide this. That was our best reading of the jurisdictional statutes and this court's case law and the Federal Circuit's case law. But if we're wrong, we'll just take the
tour all over and
sell it back to Washington D.C. Some of your questions do go to the question of, like, how hard is this objective baselessness determination going to be for us? And I really do want to address it. But, in the theory that I'm trying to proceed in order, I would like to say.
Well, if you want to start with the remedy first, that's fine with me as far as I'm concerned.
So
I think there's a serious question here about what the word injunction means. And you're fighting an uphill battle with a lot of precedent going against you, but I guess in your favor is the most recent Seventh Circuit decision in FTC v. Credit Bureau Center.
So there are two issues on the remedy. One is the injunction. All I want to say about the injunction is the district court got this absolutely right. He understood that the question of whether an injunction, either one of the three versions that they asked for, was warranted is whether they had carried their burden in showing a likelihood of recurrence. He found as fact, and his decision explains why he didn't find any showing of a likelihood of recurrence. The notion, as my friend said, that AbbVie has a history of sham litigation, I don't know where that comes from. I mean, even activists, which involved Salve, a predecessor of AbbVie, didn't involve any allegation of sham litigation. But in any event, that was a finding of fact by the judge, no likelihood of recurrence. And we think it's reviewed for clear error. We don't think any clear error was shown. But Your Honor, Judge Hardiman, the more interesting remedy question here goes to both the reverse payments claim and the sham litigation claim. And they both relate to the order of disgorgement. I want to tell you why we think, and notwithstanding some of the skeptical comments that I've heard this morning, we don't think that their complaint on reverse payments actually articulates a plausible theory of liability. And I do want to address that. But perhaps before I do, I should say on the remedy issue that even if it did, even if you thought that Judge Bartle was wrong in concluding that it failed to state a claim on pay for delay, reinstating that claim would be utterly futile because under no circumstances, we now know, could the FTC obtain any relief or in fact, and I guess this is the same thing, prove that there was any antitrust injury. The district court properly found, and because this was an issue on the remedy and the sham litigation side, properly found that Teva chose not to launch its product for reasons entirely independent of the lawsuit. And that means that not only that no disgorgement would be available, even if you found that the complaint properly alleged a reverse payment under activists, but indeed that no violation occurred, because as you explained in Wellbutrin, and the D.C. Circuit also discussed this in the Microsoft antitrust case, there was, if there was no delay in Teva's entry, then a theory of an activist theory of liability, which is pay for delay, has no antitrust injury. And therefore, we think even leaving aside the merits of the reverse payment allegations and whether they satisfied Twombly or not, it would be futile. We could play this forward. Let's say you send it back to Judge Bartle and say, yeah, we think there's enough in the complaint, notwithstanding Mr. Waxman's strenuous arguments. So, you know, go ahead and let's have discovery and let's see whether there really was an antitrust violation.
Just sorry for interrupting, but that is what we would do if this came to us directly. So basically your futility argument rests on the fact that you've already gone through discovery, summary judgment, 16-day bench trial on sham litigation. And what you're basically saying is, well, maybe, just maybe, that is a plausible claim, but based on what we know now, for our years of litigation, our 16 days of trial, there's nothing there to send them back for.
That's right. In other words, we know if you sent it back, Judge Bartle would say, the question of disgorgement, that is the question of whether we have any ill-got gains to disgorge, right, depends upon whether or not what would have happened in the but-for world. The but-for world, everybody agrees, for antitrust purposes, is but for the settlement, and indeed in the sham litigation side, it was but for the lawsuit. Assume that Teva and Bessons had never sued. What would Teva have done? AbbVie and Bessons never sued. What would Teva have done?
Is it truly futile, though? I mean, it seems that the most that your argument buys you is disgorgement wouldn't be a remedy for the reverse payment count. But, aren't we supposed to look at their complaint and say, look, that's one remedy if that's statutorily available, and that's, I think, a very important issue that needs to be addressed by the parties today. But doesn't your futility argument rest on disgorgement? I mean, it could be that maybe they say, look, we've learned some things. We didn't even get discovery. Maybe we could learn a few things. Maybe we want a certification style injunction again. Maybe that's good enough. I mean, it seems a little early to start saying no remedy ever is available.
Judge Phipps, this is an incredibly weird case, right? Because we not only had the reverse payments claim that was dismissed, and to be sure, there was no discovery on that.
Right.
But we then had a full summary judgment on sham litigation denied, go to trial. We have a long trial. We had full discovery. And when we talk about discovery here in terms of what they could or couldn't plead, let's understand that this complaint was filed not only a few weeks before generic entry by Perrigo, but after 3 years of investigation by the FTC in which they subpoenaed thousands of documents and lots of witnesses, both from Teva and AbbVie. But be that as it may, just roll this forward, Judge Phipps. You say to Judge Bartle, we don't think you should have dismissed it. Go forward. And Judge Bartle is going to say, on the issue of whether there was any injury, antitrust injury is an element of a violation of the FTC Act. On the issue of injury, as it happens, we have already had full discovery and a full trial, including expert testimony by both sides, on whether or not there was, in fact, any delay. Even if you think that there is an allegation, a properly pleaded allegation of a payment in order to delay generic entry, which is what an activist claim is, we now know, because Judge Bartle has found, not only based on the credibility of Maureen Kavanaugh, the only Teva witness who testified in the case, who interestingly was called by the FTC, but also by three objective facts that he found, that even if no lawsuit had ever been filed, sham or not, Teva was not going to enter this market for three reasons, number all of which existed in 2011. Number one, they were told by the FDA that the pump bottle presentation of this drug, which they estimated would account for more than 50% of their profits, was disallowed. Number two, their manufacturer, Cipla, as the judge found, told them, we want a $10 million payment up front or a 35% royalty. And by the way, once you agree to that, it will take us 2 years in order to be able to manufacture this. And perhaps most critically, the FDA had advised Teva and
no AB
that there would be no AB reading. And as Ms. Kavanaugh testified, Teva's entire successful history as a generic competitor had never involved a BX rated drug. They had no ability to do that. And so in thinking about both whether there is a remedy available or antitrust injury shown for the sham litigation claim, but also the reverse payments claim, there is none. We now know, because of the admittedly weird posture of this case, that after full discovery and after a full trial, the judge found, based on credibility findings, that Teva wasn't going to enter even if AbbVie and Bessant had never sued, much less settled.
Those merits arguments, those are merits arguments. Do you also argue that the judge lacked the power to order the $400+ million award?
Yes, I think that he only had the power to order it if in fact there was an antitrust injury. These are all antitrust.
Well, what if there was antitrust injury? Then I mean, does the statute allow it?
It's a 13B question,
right?
So well. Right, I forgot about 13B for a moment. So we
448 million reasons not to.
448 million reasons not to, and I have, you know, at least one representative of my client who's like, what on earth are you thinking? So we think that there are, the disgorgement award was an error for not one, not two, not three, but four separate reasons, each of them independent. One of them, the second one that I'll articulate, is in fact somewhat implicated by the Supreme Court cert grant in SEC versus right. Lew, which will be argued next month. The first reason is, as we've briefed and as Judge Sykes has explained in his opinion for the Seventh Circuit and Judge O'Scanlan also in his concurring opinion in the Ninth Circuit, Section 13B authorized, which was an amendment to the FTC Act to fill a hole, authorizes only forward-looking injunctions. It mentions injunctions six times. It doesn't mention or encompass any backward-looking monetary relief. And we think for the reasons articulated by Judge Sykes, that is correct. And there is no case law, there's no precedent in this court that the court would have to overrule.
What about Lane Labs?
So Lane Labs is actually, it's interesting because Judge Sykes relied on your opinion in Lane Labs and your opinion in FTC versus Shire Viro Pharma. In Lane Labs, what this court said is, well, gee, we have these older Supreme Court cases that seem to say that you can sometimes imply equitable relief in the event with a statute that authorizes an injunction. But then we have a more recent Supreme Court case that says, well, but if this is in the context of a reticulated statute that in other sections specifically articulates other forms of relief, you don't. And therefore, what this court said in Lane Labs is, so we really have to look at the context of this language in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And what it found was that there were no other provisions in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that elsewhere in other procedures said, yes, restitution, yes, disgorgement, yes, money damages. Whereas here we have, I mean, look, the FTC's historic and principal authority to enforce the FTC Act is through Section 5. Section 5, everybody admits, allows the imposition of monetary relief. It allows the imposition of equitable monetary relief. We have another amendment to the statute section reflected in Section 19, which is, I think, 15 U.S.C. 57B, which expressly authorizes, in the circumstances of a cause of action under 19, equitable relief. And here we have a statute that everyone agrees, as Judge Sykes explains, was introduced in order to solve a problem. The problem that the FTC articulated was, yes, we can go through these Section 5 proceedings, but in the meantime, we have no authority to stop what we believe is illegal conduct. Give us that authority. And so our argument number one on the disgorgement remedy is it's not authorized by Section 5.
The counterargument, I guess, is when that provision was adopted, it carried along with it the whole Porter-Mitchell equitable theory.
Right, and that's an argument that is completely unavailing because when you think about Porter and Mitchell, so Porter was a plain old statute that basically said, you know, you can file a cause of action.
That's a plain old statute. It's one of the biggest, most aggressive statutes ever. I mean, yeah. It's a huge statute.
Okay. And basically, I always get Porter and Mitchell mixed up, so pardon me if I've gotten them wrong, but, you know, it's like you can bring this, this authorization for an injunction also carries with it the equitable authority to restore to the people who paid, I think it was excessive rents.
There's a restitution, not necessarily a disgorgement statute.
Exactly. And the other case was, you know, an equitable apportionment case in which obviously when courts are sitting in equitable apportionment cases, they have the full range of authority. That's our argument number one. Our argument number two is even if you don't agree with that, even if you say, well, Credit Bureau Center was wrong and the old Seventh Circuit precedent that it overruled was right, it only applies to equitable relief. And the award here, the disgorgement award here, is not equitable. The FTC told the district judge, and the district court found that the award was intended to punish a violation of public law and to deter others. Under Kokesh, those are the defining features of a penalty. And Kokesh points out...
Kokesh isn't disgorgement, but it's restitution, right? But I guess Liu's going to answer that, I suppose, right?
Liu will answer whether under the SEC Act...
Right.
There is authority to obtain disgorgement, but we're not relying on that. That portion of Kokesh, the portion of Kokesh we're relying on is the passage at the very end of the court's opinion, the last paragraph before Roman numeral 3, where it says that if the remedy, one, seeks to redress harm to the public, and two, is to punish a violation and deter others from committing the same violation, rather than, quote, solely to compensate a victim for a loss.
This is public relief. This is public relief, not individual relief.
Yes, and the FTC argued that. The district judge properly found it. That's what it is.
And just to be clear, though, we aren't bound under any 13B case law.
That's correct.
So this is an issue of first impression. Obviously, we have to heed our prior reasoning in certain cases that involve different statutes or enacted at different times and have different places in the statutory regime. And what you're saying is that the unique place in the statutory regime of Section 13B makes clear that this statute is not about disgorgement. Actually, it's limited to the text that Congress decided to put in.
Right.
And that because context was such a big deal in a case like Lane Labs and even for the Seventh Circuit, recent Seventh Circuit, that when we look at context and we look at this case, when we look at overall statutory structure, disgorgement's not on the table, especially since we know from Kokesh that disgorgement's punitive.
That's correct. And, you know, I would also say I don't want to dwell on it because I do want to get to objective bit. Well, I do want to get to why the reverse payments claim doesn't state a claim on its face, doesn't state a cause of action, even leaving aside futility. And I know how much you would prefer not to hear this, but this is a case about sham litigation, and I would like to be able to say at least a few reasons why the district court erred as a matter of law. just on the disgorgement, the remedy issue, even if you didn't agree with our reading of 13B, and if you didn't agree with our reasoning that under Kokesh, and Kokesh cited the Supreme Court's decision in Austin, this is a penalty, as the term penalty has been described in Kokesh and Austin, nonetheless, there still wouldn't be any appropriate disgorgement because, as you explained in your opinion in FTC versus Shire Viropharma, under 13B, any equitable, whether there is or isn't any equitable relief available, it follows the ability of a court to impose an injunction. If there is no likelihood of recurrence and therefore no authority to impose a forward-looking injunction, this court's opinion in footnote 19 of Shiro Viropharma says there is therefore no authority to impose any equitable relief that follows on as a result of an injunction. And finally, we think that even if disgorgement were legally possible in this context, the district judge clearly erred because what it found was you owe this $440 million because I find that Perrigo would have entered in June of 2013, not December of 2014, and here's what I calculate the profits to be. But he based that factual conclusion on two findings, both of which were demonstrably wrong. Number one, he said, the only reason that the FTC took so long to give you the AB rating is that it knew that you had agreed not to enter until December of 2014. I think everybody is in agreement that is factually wrong. In fact, Perrigo's deputy general counsel testified that they chose not to make that public and did not tell the FDA that until it filed the lawsuit in the summer of 2014. The judge also said, you would have, but for AbbVie and Besson's litigation, you would have sued the FDA earlier, like within 4 months after asking for your AB certification. That is just wrong. There's nothing in the record that supports that. Mr. Solomon, again, Perrigo's deputy general counsel, said that is pure speculation. This is our regulator. We sue them only as a last resort. We did write them three letters in which we ask them to expedite this, even though, and the letters are in the record, say, we know, FDA, that you've told us that you are considering a rulemaking on the issuance of TE ratings before you grant these. We are asking for an exception. So,
can we talk about objective baselessness?
I would love to.
to begin with, should we, for evidentiary purposes, is this a preponderance or a higher standard?
Well, we think that the district judge in this regard was right, that it is a higher standard. I mean, under the Supreme Court's decision in Herman versus...
Why? Because there's a fundamental right?
Well, we're talking about the First Amendment here.
Right.
And, your sister circuit, the Federal Circuit, in other cases involving... Exercising their expertise on claims of invalidity and claims of Walker process violations all apply a clear and convincing evidence standard. And, of course, it really naturally follows because, as the Supreme Court has said, the issuance of a patent is presumed valid and it can be challenged only on clear and convincing evidence that it is not. So we think that standard was correct. We also think that we win under any of the standards. Let me just say one thing, which I'm sure the court is exquisitely aware of, but I feel like I need to say it, is as this court has explained, as the Supreme Court has explained, the sham litigation exception poses a very high hurdle on the party arguing it. It requires the proof of an exacting standard because it is in derogation of the First Amendment. That's what Knorr-Pennington and the Supreme Court's decision in Pree says, and this court's decision in Wellbutrin actually says, in the Hatch-Waxman context, the standard is particularly hard because in a Hatch-Waxman case, there's no dispute about whether there has been an act of infringement. The filing of the paragraph 4 certifications is an act of infringement, this court explained. Now, with all of that peroration out of the way, to prove, first of all, objective baselessness, the standard is that the FTC had to prove that there was no reasonable litigant that could have perceived any chance that the infringement claims might succeed.
And is objective baselessness part of the FTC's affirmative claim?
It is. Yeah. That in order to prove sham litigation, the Supreme Court said in Pree, the party invoking sham litigation has to adduce independent evidence to establish both that the claim of infringement was objectively baseless, meaning that
the judge evaluated that after an extensive trial. And I mean, the prosecution history speaks volumes here. I mean, they started with every penetration enhancer, then they reduced it to 24, and then they end up with isopropyl myristate. I mean, it's pretty
Judge
strong.
Hardiman,
it's a pretty strong record.
Judge Hardiman, I was just about to say that the prosecution record in this case, the expert testimony in this case, and in particular, I want to focus on the case law, all show the very opposite of objective baselessness. Before I get into the prosecution history, which I know requires a deep breath, let me just make two other points. Our AbbVie's opponent in this, Perrigo's Deputy General Counsel, Mr. Solomon, testified that not only did he advise Perrigo that AbbVie and Bessons had a 25% chance of prevailing, but that in Perrigo's planning documents, in game planning different scenarios, in deciding whether or not to accept AbbVie and Perrigo's take it or leave it entry by January 15th, 2015, they calculated that they had a 75% chance of winning on this infringement claim. Not a 100% chance of winning, not a 90% chance. I know what you're going to say. When have you ever advised
a client? I think maybe in my second year of practice, I told a client they were definitely going to win. And then after losing that case, I never went above 75%.
So this
very experienced trial judge was within his purview to discount those percentages the same way I just did, wasn't
so,
it?
So, the fact of the matter is not only that Mr. Solomon told the client this, but when the client was deciding in response to AbbVie and Bessons offer to settle the litigation by allowing entry 4 years later, but nonetheless before the end of the patent term, they calculated how could this come about? And they factored in not a 90%, I mean, it is just a fact that they considered that they had a 25% chance of losing. That's number one. Number two, in terms of Judge Bartle's reasoning, we cited to Judge Bartle four decisions. I think we cited more, but I have four in mind, including most recently the Eli Lilly decision, in which claim of a tangentiality exception to prosecution history estoppel to the doctrine of equivalence exception.
Okay, let's break this down. Because what really happens here is there's two sham litigation components to this. There's the sham litigation allegation against Teva, and then there's the sham litigation allegation against Perrigo. And those each have different patent prosecution history components to them. When the litigation against Teva happened, when it was, we want to protect the universe, now then we went from the universe to 24, excluding only oleic acid. Mm-hmm. Then against Perrigo, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, and then against Perrigo, it went from 24 down to 1. And one of those 24 was the one that Perrigo was using. So it seems to me that objective reasonableness or unreasonableness is a very different inquiry for Teva, where it's the universe only down to these 24. That's very similar to your Eli Lilly case. the Teva case, and Eli Lilly says there's no objective unreasonableness. But the flip side is, whatever help Eli Lilly gives you for Teva, it gives you none for Perrigo.
Oh,
and all you're relying on Perrigo is these assessments of a general counsel who won't go higher than 75%.
I don't want to be mistaken about this at all. First of all, I want to talk about what the standard is, the standard of objective reasonableness. The standard of objective reasonableness, that no reasonable person could have thought there was any chance of succeeding, either under existing case law or in an argument for an extension of existing case law, is in hec verba with the first two elements of Rule 9 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I mean, the language is virtually identical.
Rule 11?
Rule 11 says you have to certify the following things. Your complaint is not being presented for any improper purpose, such as to harass, cause unnecessarily delay, or needlessly increase the cost of litigation, and that the claims, defenses, or legal contentions are warranted by existing law or by a non-frivolous argument for extending, modifying, or reversing existing law or establishing new law. This is the finding of objective reasonableness is tantamount to a finding that when AbbVie said to its outside counsel, Munger Tolles, we want you to file this infringement litigation, what Munger Tolles should have said is we would be violating Rule 11 if we did that. And
objective unreasonableness is under this reading, and maybe there's reasons that they should conflate, but Justice Thomas and PRE didn't conflate objective reasonableness with Rule 11. He didn't instead he added a subjective unreasonableness, the court added a subjective unreasonableness component to it. So it seems like the crux of your argument is that, well, look, it wasn't a Rule 11 violation, therefore it should be objectively unreasonable. But no one's really gone quite that far yet.
So I think you may have misspoken.
Okay.
But what Pre
well,
said,
please tell me.
the argument in Pre was, if we can show scienter, if we can show subjective unreasonableness, we don't have to show objective.
And that was
and that's and the, look at Octane and the fee shifting cases, that was the case. What Justice Thomas said for the court in Pre is no, you also need to show objective reasonableness.
And when he articulated that standard, and so my point is, when he articulated that standard of objective reasonableness, he didn't articulate it the exact same as the Rule 11 standard. It seems to be that there's futility, and then there's something above futility, Rule 11, frivolousness, and then there's objective unreasonableness, which seems to make that holders of patents, maybe there's an Orr-Pennington or first element angle, that they don't exactly enjoy the same rights to sue as others, at least without fear of reprisal from the FTC.
So, Judge Phipps, I just want to say it's true that Pre doesn't reference Rule 11.
Yeah.
But if you look at the standard of what objective unreasonableness is, that the court articulates, and you read Rule 11, they are substantively one and the same. And I'm not saying, this is not a gotcha argument by me. The point is this. The FTC has filed 28J letter after 28J letter in this court arguing about Eli Lilly. And we can have an argument about, I think Eli Lilly is on all eights on both the Perrigo claim and the Teva claim,
But Perrigo, how?
I'm going to address that as soon as I finish.
Yeah, sure. Sentence.
The point is, in Eli Lilly and Primos and in Pseudoform and Regents versus Daco Cytomation, a tangentiality argument was raised in a context, Judge Hardiman, in which there was a broad claim and it was narrowed and narrowed and narrowed, which is always the case when you're talking about prosecution history estoppel. And the Federal Circuit not only said these arguments are entirely unreasonable and we're going to sanction the lawyers for making them, they all won. Now, we can have a long debate, and I'm about to give you my best argument about Perrigo and Eli Lilly. We can have a long debate about whether we're right that they compel the conclusion that our claim of infringement was meritorious or whether the FTC is right that they don't. But the fact that we can have the debate shows that they are not objectively unreasonable. Now, as to Perrigo, Your Honor, the Eli Lilly was the following. There was a claim for a cancer treatment that included as one element an antifolate, and it claimed all antifolates. There were a succession of narrowing amendments in response to objections by the examiner, ending up in a claim that only included the particular antifolate that the brand manufacturer was in fact using. And the question was, can they claim infringement by equivalence with respect to a product that is using a different antifolate, a different salt form?
The patent prosecution history in that case, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, demonstrates that it was designed and narrowed to avoid one particular antifolate. That's what happened with Teva. That patent prosecution history demonstrates that it was designed and narrowed to those 24 to avoid one particular ingredient, oleic acid. I can see that Eli Lilly is a huge help to you for Teva. But when you go from 24 to 1 with no explanation in the patent prosecution history other than kind of post hoc and interviews and stuff like this that suggest it was designed to expedite, you're outside of Eli Lilly and the help that it may afford you.
I respectfully want to push back on this because I think this is as close to precisely Eli Lilly as possible. Let me just explain. With respect to Perrigo, we have two arguments about why there was infringement. One is that pemetrexed ditromethamine, which is the equivalent, is entirely tangential to the reason that the claims were narrowed to pemetrexed disodium, another antifolate. And that argument that we have, the argument was, again, in Eli Lilly, the examiner said there are two prior references that are a problem for your claim for all antifolates. One was a patent called the Arsenin patent, which included the antifolate methotrexate. And another was a patent, the Johns patent, that listed a whole bunch of antifolates, including petromexit disodium. The claim was narrowed to have a subclass that didn't include methotrexate and then ultimately just pemetrexed disodium. And the issue was the narrowing of the claim not to include in the last instance pemetrexed ditromethamine tangential to the reason for the amended claim? That is, when you amended the claim, what patent-related objection were you trying to avoid? And what the court said in Eli Lilly was the amendment was to avoid the Arsenin claim that claimed the folate methotrexate. The Johns patent, which also named the issue in this case, there was no effort to avoid it. The argument was that the Arsenin patent taught away from it. Now, in our case, we have, again, two patents at issue. There's the Mac patent, which taught the use of oleic acid as a penetration enhancer. And then there's the Allen patent, which lists a whole number of penetration enhancers in the context of a nitroglycerin cream. The patent examiner's rejection of the original claim says this is obvious over Mac because Mac discloses a penetration enhancer with testosterone formulation. And Allen discloses all sorts of other kinds of penetration enhancers, albeit not in the context of a testosterone treatment. We amended the claim, as you say, in the first instance to include a category of 24, which included both isoteric acid and, well, the
palmate, maybe?
Isopropyl myristate. And what we said, and again, this is in the prosecution history record, you know, at pages 1029 to 1038, what we said is we are narrowing this claim to avoid the referent, the claimed obviousness under Mack. In order to, Mack taught oleic acid. We are amending the claim so it doesn't include oleic acid.
Eli Lilly's helping you. Up until this point, the wind that Eli Lilly gives is at your back and you're riding downhill up until now. Right. Possibly.
And Eli Lilly, as we point out in response to their latest 28-J letter, in Eli Lilly there were also successive narrowing amendments. In this case, there was a further narrowing to a single penetration enhancer. Just as in Eli Lilly, there was ultimately a narrowing to a single antifolate.
But in that 23 that were left behind is the compound that Perrigo wanted to use, and I don't think that was present in Eli Lilly.
Well, I don't.
And the examiner it didn't focus only on isopropyl myristate. The examiner also talked about what in my layman's mind I call the recipe. I mean, there was a reference to the quantity, not the quantity, but the compound, right? Did not the examiner emphasize that?
So what happened?
And the reason I say that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm correct in understanding that the examiner not only homed in on isopropyl myristate, but also homed in on the particular composition of it, then it stands to reason that any penetration enhancer that's not isopropyl myristate with that composition is not infringing.
I'm sorry, Judge. Judge Hardiman, but that is the opposite of what the Federal Circuit explained in Lilly. The argument in Lilly was, hey, you ultimately came down to only one antifolate, and you didn't include these other ones, and that's game, set, match. And what the
But prosecution history matters. It's not just where you start and where you stop. You're treating Eli Lilly as a starting point and a stopping point case, not you know, the local. You're treating it as an express, not the local bus that stops at every step along the way. And this case is different because there are stops along the way, and one of those stops is really, really important in terms of whether your client had an objective reason for suing.
Okay, I'll just say again, and I won't say it again, there were stops along the way also in Lilly. I will also say that the very fact that we are having this discussion about Lilly, and we haven't yet talked about the Federal Circuit's finding of tangentiality in Primos and Regents and in situ form, all of which there are arguments back and forth. The only question is whether somebody in our position, whether the in-house lawyers at AbbVie and Bessons or Munger Tolles and Foley Lardner, when they filed that, Foley Hoag, when they filed that lawsuit, were engaging in something that was objectively unreasonable, that no one could have thought they could possibly prevail. And the very fact that there are four cases that we think are very hard to distinguish going the other way, actually going the other way, much far from basically saying, well, that was an unreasonable argument to make, takes this out of the extremely exacting standard that the First Amendment references. Now, as my last, your point, I can tell I haven't satisfied you on what happened between October and December. The FTC, what happened between October and December is the following. They don't hear anything from the examiner. They amend their claims in October to include 24 penetration enhancers. No rejection of those claims ever. They have a conference with the patent examiner on December 6th. And in the conference, as the examiner's notes reflect, the examiner says, your product uses isopropyl myristate. I'm prepared to say that isopropyl myristate is not obvious under Mack. And two and a half weeks later, they amend their complaint, they amend their patent claim to claim only isopropyl myristate. At that point, there is no rejection of the broader claim that included isotiric acid. None whatsoever. All the examiner has said is, I'm looking at your product. I agree that your product is not. And in the context in which that occurred, with very little time left on FDA marketing exclusivity for this product, the company made a decision, let's get the patent on our product. The fact that the claim was, quote, over-narrowed is not only a commonplace under the doctrine of equivalence and prosecution history estoppel, but as the Federal Circuit has explained, it is the only reason that tangentiality and foreseeability and the other exceptions to prosecution history estoppel exist. The Federal Circuit has explained repeatedly these patentees always over-narrow their claims. That's why these doctrines exist, to evaluate whether or not the reason was tangential and whether, in this case, it was tangential to Mac. Now,
but how does for we can compare the prosecution history here with the prosecution histories in these other cases, the four cases and the other cases that you're talking about. But for three non-patent lawyers, can you give us a sentence or a paragraph? What is the test for when the claim, the aspects of a claim are only tangential to the amendments that we're talking about? How do we know when what that looks like?
Right. So the tangentiality arrives only in an instance in which original claims have been narrowed in order to, as the Federal Circuit has explained, overcome a statutory obstacle to patentability. The only obstacle to patentability here mentioned by the examiner in the rejection was MAC, which used oleic acid. When you determine whether or not, although ultimately the claim that was granted and patented was narrowed only to a particular substance, you have to look at what, again, the Federal Circuit has said, the rationale underlying the amendment. And the question is, did that rationale bear no more than a tangential relation to the equivalent in question? And so here, what that means is you ultimately got a patent on isopropyl myristate. You are claiming infringement by equivalence of a product that uses isoteric acid. Why did you narrow your claims to, in this instance, it's a two-step stage, as it is in most of these other cases. Why did you narrow your claims only to that one particular penetration enhancer? You look at the prosecution history to determine that. The prosecution history and the pages that I cited in response to the rejection are, we narrowed it to avoid MAC, and we don't need to avoid Allen because, and again, this is recited in the prosecution history, MAC teaches away from the use of any other penetration enhancer.
No, that I don't see that. I really don't. That's why they amended down to 24, was to avoid MAC. Mm-hmm. After they avoided MAC, they didn't need to amend anymore. Their First Amendment took care of MAC. It's really strange to say our First Amendment takes care of MAC, and then to say, aha, you know what we need to do again? We need to amend again to take care of MAC, especially when the prosecution history seems satisfied, what little there is, that First Amendment did take care of MAC.
Right, and I finally understand your point, and it goes to the other reason why we think that we would prevail on an infringement claim with respect to Perrigo, and that is the narrowing has to have been to overcome a statutory obstacle to patentability. Now you say, and I agree with you, that the October amendment did that. It said, we're now claiming a whole bunch of penetration enhancers that are structurally, functionally, and chemically different than oleic acid, and MAC teaches away from the use of them. Done. Over. There was no further rejection by the patent examiner. And so our second argument with respect to isoteric acid, which maybe it should be our first argument, is this was not a narrowing made to, quote, overcome a statutory obstacle to patentability.
It was done because the examiner told you to do it.
In the interview.
Examiner basically,
and you wanted
said,
to get it you, done.
Exactly. The examiner said, look, I'm not rejecting your October claims. You want to move fast. That's why you're in here darkening my door. you've only got one penetration enhancer. I'm convinced that that penetration enhancer is patentable. Conduct yourself accordingly.
In a certain composition, right?
In the, right, with your penetration enhancer, you know, with this one penetration enhancer. Now, I just submit that we can have arguments, and if this were being argued in the Federal Circuit, maybe there would be a long argument back and forth about whether Lilly and in situ form and the proper understanding of this patent prosecution history does or does not make a winnable case for infringement. But we're not even in the same time zone as that question. The question is only whether the AbbVie and Bisson's lawyers, inside and outside counsel, when they brought this lawsuit, were behaving in a manner that is unlawful. And we are so far from that. We wouldn't have all these exchanges about under the 28J letters if this were an open and shut answer. I give Judge Phipps, I mean, you clearly seem like you are, in fact, able to adjudicate this, even if you were on the Federal Circuit. But I'm not saying that there are no arguments back and forth. I'm saying that we think that in light of the way that the Federal Circuit has treated very, very similar claims of infringement by equivalence, even in the face of the doctrine of prosecution history estoppel, this was reasonable. And in any event,
I think we understand your argument on that, Mr. Waxman. We need to hear again from Mr. Hoffman. So is there anything else you want to add?
Yes, I would just say that there is that under the First Amendment, as Pree explains, it is incumbent on the FTC not only to prove objective unreasonableness, but also subjective baselessness. And we can talk about what could or couldn't be proven here. But what the judge did, the reason he erred is he said, I find that these are objectively unreasonable. These were knowledgeable patent attorneys. They knew because of the Hatch-Waxman automatic stay, which is an outside limit of 30 months, this was going to be very valuable. And I find that they acted in a manner, you know, essentially with scienter in this case. That cannot be right because, and the FTC is
a valid. Because you protected all the key exchanges through privilege.
Well, let me go back to that for a second. First of all, let me just say that however you can or can't prove, the FTC has an independent obligation affirmatively to prove subjective baselessness. What the judge said is, I'm going to infer it from the following three facts. One, I've already found these claims objectively baseless. Two, lawyers made this decision. Three, there's the Hatch-Waxman automatic stay. The Hatch-Waxman Act, with all due respect to Judge Bartle, cannot trump the First Amendment. You can't say, well, sham litigation is really a two-part test in every area other than Hatch-Waxman, where the Hatch-Waxman structure of an automatic stay supplies the predicate for a finding of subjective baselessness. Now, to your question, Your Honor, about the attorney-client privilege, I want to say two things. The FTC says, well, in a situation like this, how could we possibly bear our burden to introduce independent evidence? The answer may be, maybe there wasn't anything you could do, but it's none under the First Amendment, it's nonetheless your burden. But those aren't our first two-order answers. Our first one answer is, in these cases, there are any number of things that a challenger could adduce. It could have, for example, brought in evidence, adduced evidence that AbbVie and Bisson's, they filed these lawsuits, and they had already taken steps to enter with their authorized generic when the 30 months ended. They could have already made plans to shutter their manufacturing line or reduce their manufacturing line because when generic entry happens, they're going to be selling far fewer dosages. They could have gone to Teva and Perrigo and said, we'll just settle this litigation. We'll let you enter on when the 30 months extended. They could have hired non-patent lawyers who engaged in the kind of delaying discovery abuse that evinces a desire to obtain a procedural advantage, but otherwise. And finally, on the attorney-client privilege, I must say that for the life of me, I don't understand how, if there is an argument that these decisions were made by lawyers, The lawyer looked at the claim. The lawyer decided we're filing this claim. I don't understand why they didn't, why in a situation like that, they can't try and challenge the assertion of attorney-client privilege. The argument is the lawyer looked at it. The lawyer is an experienced patent lawyer. The lawyer decided to sue. There's no
like
privilege.
Like the First Amendment, that's also sacrosanct.
Yeah, that's kind of mental impressions.
Putting on my district judge hat, I think the trial judge could make an adverse inference unless you chose to unlock the sacrosanct privilege, and because it was within your power to waive it.
The judge said he was not drawing any inferences from the invocation. And number two, I have to say, and I've done this as a plaintiff. I've also defended it as a defense lawyer. You know, what the other side comes in and says, look, our theory, we intend to prove that they acted with scienter. The attorneys made the decision. They acted with scienter in order to secretly secretly pursue an objective that violates the law. There is an exception to the attorney-client privilege for that, which was not invoked here.
Right.
So that's my argument.
Thank you very much.
They didn't prove monopoly power. Thank you.
All right. Now I know why you wanted to reserve 15 minutes.
Yeah. Obviously, Mr. Waxman touched on a lot of topics, and I think the main ones were on the reverse payment, his futility argument, the availability of monetary relief under 13B, objective baselessness, and then briefly the second prong of PRE. So I'd like
go whatever order you want, but my preference would be start with the ones that you think you can respond to most briefly, and then we'll spend a lot of time on whichever ones.
I think briefly on the futility argument, I think Judge Phipps made this point. I mean, their argument is that even if there's a remand on reverse payment, there's no monetary relief in view of the district court's factual finding on Teva. So number one, of course, even if there's no monetary relief, we could still seek injunctive relief. Whether an injunction is appropriate or not is something the district court would have to decide in its equitable discretion. And so that would be an injunction against reverse payments. So there certainly is something to litigate there. Beyond that, I mean, our view is that, you know, since we didn't get to take discovery or present evidence on the effect of the reverse payment on Teva's thinking, that you would really need to reconsider the question of Teva's market entry if you reinstate the reverse payment claim. But that issue would have to be reopened.
That's a matter for the district judge to sort out on remand, right, if we sent that back?
It's a matter for the district court to start out on remand as long as he's doing it consistent with your mandate. So I think you would need to say to him the court should consider whether that should be reopened.
Okay.
So that's really all I have to say on that score. Let me move to the availability of monetary relief under Section 13B.
In other words, why was the Seventh Circuit wrong in Credit Bureau?
Right. Well, the Seventh Circuit and Credit Bureau, this case is controlled by the Supreme Court's decision in Porter and Mitchell and this court's decision in Lane Labs. What the Seventh Circuit said in Credit Bureau is, I think Porter and Mitchell are sort of, dead letters. They've been undermined by the later decision of the Supreme Court in Megrig. But this court addressed that exact argument in Lane Labs and said, no, Megrig is really devoted to a very particular set of facts.
If I believe it correctly, what this court said in around 2005 in Megrig was that it presented at that point in time a very close call. That was towards the middle of the opinion. And then almost as an outro to the opinion, it said if there was just a little, and I'm paraphrasing, if there's just a little bit more guidance from the Supreme Court, that might tilt us one way or the other. That wasn't Section 13B, that was Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And then, so we have a different statute coming in a different structure, fitting into the structure of a statutory framework differently. And then we also have a little more guidance from the Supreme Court on disgorgement specifically in Kokesh. So since Megrig was already a close call, that was tied to one individual statute that's not the statute we're dealing with, and our, this panel and the panel said if we just had a little more guidance, that might sway us one way, and not only do we get more guidance, we get more guidance in the context of disgorgement. Doesn't that steer us into Credit Bureau being the way to go?
No, I don't think so. And, of course, Credit Bureau did not rely on Kokesh at all. Credit Bureau's...
Well, they didn't have Lane Labs either.
So, Credit Bureau's argument was about Megrid, which this court addressed in Lane Labs. And I don't think Kokesh addresses the issue that's taken on in Lane Labs or in...
doesn't address the issue, but it seems to be a signal that we're heading in a different direction. And we'll know more on that score when the court opines and moves. Right?
Sure. And I prefer, I think the court shouldn't decide these things based on signal. It should decide these things based on what the Supreme Court has said. And at the moment, the law is Porter and Mitchell. The Supreme Court has
said it. Porter and Mitchell are right. They're still there. But let me challenge you a little on Lane Labs, because I think...
And if you're wrong, you can just grab the case.
Sure. There's a chance that Lane Labs actually works against you, and let me try to make the case why it works against you, and you can tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay.
In that case, we did interpret Mitchell and Porter, and we said that it charted an analytical course that seems fairly easy to follow. District court sitting in equity, and I'm quoting from the opinion at 225. Mm-hmm. District court sitting in equity may order restitution unless there is a clear statutory limitation on the district court's equitable jurisdiction and powers, and restitution is permitted only where it furthers the purposes of the statute. And after that, we held that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act authorized restitution because it empowers district courts to, quote, restrain violations, end quote, of the act. So... it would appear that the statute at issue in Lane Labs was more of a generic equity powers of the court statute, whereas here under 13B we have the word injunction. I don't see any of that sort of expansive language in this statute that says, oh, in any other equitable relief the court shall deem just and proper or things like that. You see my concern.
I see where you're going, and let me first of all. You know, on that page that you're pointing to, let me draw your attention to the sentences below that, which says, numerous courts have followed this approach, that is the approach this court's adopted, in upholding by the court's power to order restitution under several different statutes that granted open-ended enforcement powers. See FTC versus GM Merchandising Corp. So the first thing the court pointed to in support of its rule was a case under the FTC Act recognizing the authority to grant monetary relief under that statute. So I think, you know, it's important to keep that in mind. In terms of,
but this is a revisionist view, right? The Credit Bureau opinion goes against a tremendous weight of authority the other way, right?
Yes,
that tremendous weight of authority, according to the Seventh Circuit, Judge Sykes' opinion, is, well, look, you know, we're not counting noses, and those were all very atextual decisions. And here, when we really dig into the text of the statute, it actually goes the other way.
I don't think they were atextual decisions. I think that Porter and Mitchell rest on an understanding that, that monetary relief, that, you know, injunctions may be reparative as well as preventive, and that in order to, and there's a long tradition of this in, you know, going back to, well, I can't remember the name of the case, but it's the one that involves the Bank of the United States, Osborne, Chief Justice Marshall, in which the court affirmed an injunction that required a bank to return money that was improperly withheld. But
was that under a statute that was empowered an agency such as yours to seek an injunction, or was that a case involving the general equitable powers of the court?
Right.
Once we're in, the point I'm making, the distinction I'm trying to draw is between the historic equity jurisdiction, where the chancellor in equity can do almost anything, and statutory interpretation, where the statute empowers an agency such as yours, to do certain delimited things, rather than just sort of...
Sure, and what the Supreme Court says in Porter very clearly is that when Congress authorizes district courts to, you know, in an agency case such as this, when Congress authorizes district courts to grant an injunction, it is invoking the equity jurisdiction of the court. And unless Congress says otherwise in specific language or by a necessary and specific implication, that that invokes the entire equity jurisdiction of the court.
All right, then if that is true, it sounds like an argument that Kokesh was wrongly decided. It sounds like an argument that says disgorgement's available, restitution's available, any other equitable relief that you can think of is available, even when the statute doesn't mention any of those pieces of relief. As long as the statute mentions the word injunction, we know we're all in equity land, and every statute where Congress has specifically given powers to agencies to seek disgorgement, to seek restitution, et cetera, that's all surplusage.
Right. So, no, and I'm certainly not arguing that Kokesh was wrongly decided. Of course, it wouldn't matter if I was.
It wouldn't matter what we think.
But, I mean, Kokesh did not involve and expressly reserve the question of whether equitable monetary relief or whether the disgorgement remedy was available under the statute. Now, I mean, there are a couple questions lurking in Kokesh, and I think one of those is going to, you know, it will likely be addressed in the Liu decision. It's really, I think, not the question that this court has to decide, but that's the question of whether, you know, SEC disgorgement, and, you know, the key factor of SEC disgorgement is that the SEC has, you know, they can pay it to consumers, or, and often they just pay it to the government, and that looks a lot like a penalty. And, you know, the question there is, is that outside the scope of a court's equity power? Is that something that's a penalty and hence not equitable? The question here is, does the statute allow equitable monetary remedies? The relief that we're seeking.
I have to say, I read this many times in your brief, and you just said it twice. Equitable monetary remedies to me is oxymoronic.
Didn't we say that in Shire?
I don't think you said that in Shire. I think what the court said in Shire was that the question in Shire was about whether we were able to get into court in the first place, and the court said, if you don't satisfy the is or is about to standard, you can't bring a claim for either a preventive injunction or for equitable monetary remedies. With respect to the question of, you know, injunction means only a preventive injunction, I think...
No, it can mean a mandatory injunction. It can mean, you know, go paint the sidewalk. But equitable money, when a lawyer goes into court and says, judge, I want an injunction, give me $100,000, the judge will look at him and say, well, I'm not a chancellor in equity if you're asking for $100,000.
No.
That's an action at law. So this equitable, I don't know where this equitable monetary relief came from, but it sure strikes me as oxymoronic.
Well, I think that it has a long tradition in equity as the Supreme Court,
well,
in Porter and Mitchell.
Porter's 1960, okay.
That the Supreme Court continues to cite and rely on. It cited it in Kokesh. It cited it in more recent decisions. So there's no indication that the court has overturned or limited Porter, and this court in Lane Labs addressed that very question and said, yeah, you know what, we think there are some indications that the Supreme Court might want to rethink this or whatever, but for now, we're sticking with Porter, I think this court is bound by that.
I suppose that your strongest argument that somehow equity can implicate money would be this hypothetical, which is someone deposits $100 in a safety deposit box, crisp $100 bill that maybe their grandmother gave to them. They say, I want that $100 bill back. The bank says no. They say, okay, I'm suing in equity. I want you to give my money back. It's $100. That's just the race that I want back. I guess you could bring a companion claim for damages. Say, well, if you won't give me my $100 back out of my safety deposit box, then I'd like $100 damages at law. But unless you're playing with a distinction like that, if you're really playing for damages or something like that that's designed to make someone whole for a loss, not to give the specific race back to them, then you're outside of equity, aren't you?
It's a good example that you've given. Certainly, equity does permit an injunction like that, a restorative injunction that says give the money back.
Unless the $100 bill is worth $1 million because it's exotic, the judge is going to order the payment of $100. He's not going to order that $100 bill to be returned.
Correct. equity permits that.
How does that help you? Because the fact that money's fungible, I don't know how that helps you in equity. I mean, to Judge Phipps's hypothetical, the whole reason that's equity is if it's equitable, it presupposes that there's something unique about that res. And here, we're not talking about a unique res. We're talking about $400+ million.
Nothing unique about those $400 million. There's nothing unique about the res in Judge Phipps's example. It's simply a $100 bill that's as good as any other $100
bill. Okay, then maybe. But I'm going to ask him to clarify his hypo, because as I understand his hypo, if there's nothing unique about that $100 bill and that $100 bill is worth $100, then in my understanding, the judge is going to enter an order requiring the bank to pay the party $100.
Right.
Not going to order the delivery of the crisp $100 bill.
We don't raise the hand of equity unless
there's something unique about it.
Unless you absolutely need it.
Now, if grandma signed the $100 bill and I don't want the $100 to spend it, I want to frame it because it's his grandma's signature on it, that's equity, right?
So the situation that Judge Phipps is describing is exactly the situation that arises in the vast majority of FTC cases, where someone has, in effect, improperly through some illicit scheme, taken money from someone else, and we're suing to get the money back.
To make that person whole through what is, it feels a lot like damages.
Right. There is certainly true that in some circumstances, the restitution remedy looks a lot like a damages remedy, although damages allows you to do a lot of things restitution wouldn't. For example, in the damages context, you're holding on to my $100. As a result, I wasn't able to invest in some other opportunity that would have netted me $1,000. I have consequential damages.
Well, that's why there's flavors of damages. There's actual damages. There's expectation. There's all different flavors of damages. What we're concerned about is that line between equity and damages.
Right. And what I would say is there are plenty of circumstances in which the equitable remedy and the damages remedy may come out to the same place, but they're not, doesn't mean they're the same remedy. And again, there is a huge body of case law from multiple courts, and supported by the Supreme Court decision in Porter and Mitchell, recognizing that when there is an authority to grant an injunction, the court has the authority to award monetary relief in connection with that. That's part of the court's equitable authority. And again, you know, Kokesh doesn't address that issue, and
Kokesh goes to the penalty question more.
Kokesh goes to the penalty question, and if, just to be very clear, in this case, although the court used the term disgorgement, he also made it very clear that we were talking about returning money to consumers. Consumers were overcharged, and the money was going to be returned to them, and the judgment provides that the money will be put in a fund to be returned to consumers and other purchasers, and we've made a commitment that no money will go to the government. So this, you know, whatever the court holds in lieu and whatever the situation was in Kokesh, our view is that this particular remedy is not a penalty.
Do you have the power to change your mind on that? Is there an enforceable court order to make sure the money doesn't go to the government?
Well, what the order says is that if there's money left over, the court will decide what to do with it after hearing from the parties. It doesn't say no money will go to the Treasury, but I'm making that commitment right now. If the court wants to remand to put that in the order, we have no problem with that. But we are not going to seek to have any of this money paid to the government. If the court has questions, does the court have other questions on monetary relief?
Ready to move on.
Okay. So let me turn to objective baselessness. And I've got a couple of things to say on this, but let me start with the fact that this case was decided in a very thorough opinion by a very experienced district court judge who's handled dozens of patent cases. He was very aware of the high standard that you need to meet to show objective baselessness, and he was satisfied that this was the exceptional case where that was met.
In some sort of philosophical sense, there's no case that's objectively baseless because you never know what a court or a jury is going to do, right? But that can't be the standard.
Right, we don't
have a doctrine.
That's right. That's not the standard. There's always, you know, miracles occur. They happen all the time. You know, as as you were saying in your colloquy with Mr. Waxman, you know, if I think I have 100% chance of winning this case, I don't tell the client I have 100% chance of winning this case, because invariably, you know, things that no one anticipated do occur. So that's not really the analysis. The analysis depends on, you know, what would a reasonable lawyer, in this case, it's a question of legal analysis, what would a reasonable litigant think based on the prosecution history record in this case? And let me just start with the Eli Lilly case because going back to the comment that you said. I think this is as clear a case of prosecution history estoppel as you can get, because we have a situation where they started out with a very broad claim that said any penetration enhancer could mean millions of things. Then to overcome the rejections, they narrowed that to a group of 24. And then they met with the examiner, who said, well, I'm willing to allow these ones. So they amended the complaint again. They canceled their very broad claims and narrowed them to just focus on isopropyl myristate, which was the substance used in Androgel. And then to really resolve the examiner's objections, they narrowed it to isopropyl myristate in particular amounts. So they gave up all this stuff. And then they turned around and said, in litigation, and said, well, we're not really limited to isopropyl myristate in the first place. I mean, if you accept Mr. Waxman's argument, the patent still covers everything in the world except for oleic acid. That just can't be squared with the record in this case or the case law as the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court have set it forth. Turn to Eli Lilly. Judge Phipps, you're exactly right. Eli Lilly has no bearing on the case against Perrigo. Their main argument with Perrigo on Perrigo involves whether it was the amendment was for a reason related to patentability, which isn't even addressed in Eli Lilly. And that's important to keep in mind, simply because the monetary relief in this case is based on Perrigo's market entry, since the court found Teva wouldn't have entered. So, I mean, Eli Lilly doesn't affect that. But I would say, even as to Teva, there's a very obvious distinction between Eli Lilly and this case. In Eli Lilly, the prior art that was cited by the examiner didn't disclose the alleged equivalent. In this case, the Allen prior art, which is one of the two pieces of prior art the examiner cited, expressly disclosed isopropyl palmitate, which was Teva's enhancer. And that's critically important, because one of the black letter rules that the Federal Circuit has said in the Board of Tangentiality is that an amendment made to avoid prior art that contains the equivalent in question is not tangential. It is central to the allowance of the claim. That's the Festo en banc decision, 344 F3rd at 1369. So in light of that, the fact that Allen expressly disclosed isopropyl palmitate, no reasonable litigant could properly have believed that isopropyl palmitate was merely tangential.
Let me just ask this, sorry for interrupting, but even if the prosecution history bears out that the number one reason, at least at that point in time, maybe the sole reason for the amendment was to avoid oleic acid.
Well, so the argument that Mr. Waxman is making is that, oh, this amendment wasn't to address Allen, it was simply to address oleic acid. And again, that simply can't be squared with the prosecution history. If you look at what the examiner said, and you can look in pages, I think it's starting at page 1014 to 1016 of the joint appendix. What the examiner said is not, oh, you have a problem with oleic acid. What she said is that it's obvious because of the combination of Mac and Allen. She said Mac discloses a testosterone gel. Allen discloses a bunch of enhancers, including isopropyl myristate. It would be obvious to a person of skill in the art to take the enhancers listed in Allen and put, you know, to take the testosterone gel listed in Mac and combine it with the enhancers listed in Allen. So in order to overcome that objection, although the broadest claim did disclose, you know, everything in the world, there were narrower claims that were focused on isopropyl myristate, and she rejected those claims as well. So if she were simply focused on oleic acid, she wouldn't have rejected those claims. If you then look at, if you look at what AbbVie, what they filed in their First Amendment, then their remarks, they do talk about mapanoleic acid, but their argument there is not, oh, well, this doesn't contain oleic acid, so it has no problem. They address Allen. You know, they say that, well, there's no motivation to combine Mac and Allen. That's the argument that they were making. So the whole amendment is designed to get around Allen. Now, the argument that Mr. Waxman has made here is, well, they can't have been trying to get around Allen because they left isopropylmuriate in. Now Allen discloses isopropylmuriate. But they addressed that problem in two different ways over the course of their amendments. They narrowed the claims to isopropylmuriate in specific amounts, which is not disclosed in Allen. Allen says isopropylmuriate, but doesn't say how much isopropylmuriate. And second, they submitted this.
So does that mean that if someone came forward with a similar product with isopropylmuriate in a different amount, that would not be infringing in your view?
It would not be literally infringing. Okay. So you have to, I mean, you know, you have to satisfy every limitation of the patent. So one way one could work around it is to say isopropylmuriate in a different amount, but that's not what was done here. The other thing that they did was they submitted a declaration pointing to the commercial success of Androgel, which, you know, was described in the patent as a formula containing isopropylmuriate. And they said, look, that's a secondary consideration showing non-obvious. What ultimately won the day for them on the narrow claims was that they had isopropylmuriate in particular amounts. And if you look at the examiner's notice of allowance, she says at page J1152, the prior art doesn't teach the use of the particular ingredients herein in the specific amounts. So going back, and maybe it's helpful, I mean, you seem to have a very good grasp of the prosecution's record. But, I mean, it may be helpful for me to just sort of go through the key points of how this transpired, because I think it relates to the Perrigo. So, again, they start with a very broad claim that covers everything under the sun. The examiner says, obvious in light of Mac and Allen. It's obvious to combine these two things. So they do two things at that point. First, they narrow the broad claim to the group of 24. And second, they add new claims, and they're claims 61 and 62, and those are the ones that are focused on isopropylmuriate in particular amounts. They then meet with the examiner, and we have a one-page summary of her handwritten notes, which is at page, I think it's JA1084. I'm going to my recollection there, but I'll double-check that. But in any event, she says, okay, claims 61 and 62 are allowable over the prior art. So she's looking at all these claims. She clearly thinks they haven't met their burden yet with respect to the very broad claim, the one through 24, but she's satisfied as to the claims 61 and 62. So what does AbbVie do? They decide we're going to cancel the broad claim, and they file an amendment that says, at the very front, says, thank you for meeting with us, examiner. They explicitly reference the interview. We'd like to cancel claim one, the broad claim. And they amended all the claims. Initially, they amended them all just to focus on isopropylmuriate, but then they filed another amendment that narrowed all the claims down to the specific amounts.
Can we just back up at one point, sure, of time, since we're already in a bit of the weeds on patent prosecution history?
I know, I told not to get into the weeds, but I love them so
well,
much.
Well, I guess my thought is, wasn't there an explanation that the amendment from the universe to 24 was in the reason that oleic acid was excluded was to distinguish the claim from Mac, not Allen?
No. I think if you look at what they said, is they said, the examiner says it's obvious to combine Mac and Allen.
I'm quoting from the JA 1032, but it basically says, talking about Mac, focuses on the superiority of oleic acid, again talking about Mac, provides no teaching or suggestion to substitute the claim penetration enhancers in place of oleic acid. So, I mean, I think, isn't it then from that passage fair to say that the amendment of the universe to 24 was an amendment designed about oleic acid and not about Allen?
No.
Okay, why?
What they're saying in that passage is that, you know, examiner, you said it's obvious to combine Mac and Allen. Anyone of skill in the art would do that. We don't think it's obvious because Mac teaches that oleic acid is better than those other things. So a person of skill in the art wouldn't have the motivation to
to look at inferior enhancers.
Right. So to look at other enhancers
that,
right.
that would arguably be so, inferior.
Right. So that's the argument they're making. Simply eliminating oleic acid though wouldn't have resolved the examiner's rejection. And if you look, you know, they throughout this they talk about the combination of things. If you look on the bottom of page JA 1030, they say it's apparent that Mac and Sam Orr, in view of Allen and Chan, do not teach or suggest the mere fact that references can be combined doesn't render it obvious. And going through, you know, they completely repeatedly talk about the combination. So it's very clear that what they had to do was to overcome the examiner's rejection was deal with the combination of Mac and Allen. And as I've said, since Allen expressly discloses isopropyl palmitate, you know, whatever else you say, that can't be tangential under the black letter rules of the Federal Circuit.
So again, this is in the weeds, but what I've heard from you would suggest that the desire to overcome both is the reason that the new application listed 24 specific materials or compounds instead of just saying something other than oleic acid. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well,
because they could have said just something other than oleic acid,
right.
but according to you, that wouldn't have been enough because there was this combo that meant more than just oleic acid.
They have to say what that something is, right?
Right.
You can't get a patent on everything other than oleic acid because that's an indefinite set. Or can you? Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know the answer to that, but that's not a typical form of drafting claims. But you certainly could have drafted this in such a way that you would have kept in the, you know, you could have drafted the group of 24 to include Teva's enhancer, but not oleic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you had done that, they would have preserved it. And, you know, we'd be in a situation like we are with Perrigo where the arguments are, I think, you know, even less colorable. But the fact of the matter is that in order to overcome the rejection based on Mac and Allen, they chose to examine their claims, and in doing so, they surrendered isopropyl palmitate. It was expressly disclosed in the prior art, and that's really the end of story. I mean, as I think Mr. Waxman said, game, set, match. I think that's it. Let me talk briefly about Perrigo. I think Judge Phipps, you seem to have it exactly correct.
I speak only for myself, and my questions only reflect my views. You know
that,
right?
I understand that completely, but I think that you've got it right. So they make two different arguments about Perrigo. The first one is that, well, this was just a, you know, this December amendment was just a voluntary amendment. It wasn't to respond to the outstanding rejection. So first of all, the Federal Circuit says very clearly that even a voluntary amendment can give rise to prosecution history estoppel. That's in Festo 344 F3rd at 1366. But in any event, if you look at the text of the amendment, it's JA 1095. They say in that amendment, we request reconsideration and withdrawal of the outstanding rejections. So they clearly viewed this document as responding to the original rejection. And when the examiner granted the patent, this is at page JA 1152, she said the amendments altogether are sufficient to overcome the rejection. You know, she clearly viewed the amendments as responsive to the original rejection. And if you look at what happened here, again, they met with the examiner. She said, I'm willing to allow the claims that are directed to isopropyl myristate in particular amounts. And by the way, it's worth looking at the page JA 587, which is the email from AbbVie's prosecuting attorney to the client right after that meeting. And she says, in brief, the examiner will allow composition claims directed to the androgel composition, i.e. focused on isopropyl mirror state. So they certainly understood that what the examiner was saying is, I'm going to allow the isopropyl mirror state. At that point, they canceled the broader claims, surrendering all that prior, all that stuff, including Perrigo's enhancer, which was expressly listed. So all of this was done in order to get a patent. That was for reasons of patentability. So I think that there's just no, the district court properly found that no reasonable litigant could have accepted that this amendment wasn't for purposes of patentability. As to the tangentiality argument, again, I think you got it right. You know, they've argued that, well, this is tangential because the reason for the December amendment was to distinguish oleic acid. But obviously it wasn't, because oleic acid had already been surrendered by the earlier amendment. So they clearly were not trying to trying to distinguish oleic acid when they made that amendment. They were trying to narrow it to what the examiner said she would allow, which was isopropyl mirror state. And eliminating the isostearic acid, which was expressly listed, was not tangential to that. AbbVie hasn't offered any other rationale for this amendment. So again, the district court did a very thorough review here and got this exactly right. These are arguments that no reasonable litigant could have accepted. So I think that covers me on objective baselessness. Let me just
brief remarks on subjective.
Yeah, on subjective baselessness, let me just say that, you know, this is a finding of fact. First of all, I wouldn't call it subjective baselessness. I think the standard really is intent to interfere with competition. Right. And so that's a somewhat misleading thing. This is a finding of fact. It's subject to a clearly erroneous review. The district court here looked at a lot of evidence. It looked to, you know, I think it did properly take into account the finding of objective baselessness, as well as the fact that the lawyers who made the decision were highly experienced, that they had access to the...
When you say took into account, that suggests that it's not a problem for the district court to view objective baselessness and subjective intent as interrelated. Well, they're not these...
How much work is objective baselessness allowed to do
right. At
the subjective prong?
Certainly, in the Hatch-Waxman context, where someone, you know, in the circumstances of this case, where there are billions of dollars at stake and someone files an objectively baseless lawsuit, you know, absent any other evidence, you know, there's a, I think, a strong inference that this was done to interfere with competition rather than to win the lawsuit. But the district court also looked at a lot of other evidence which backed up that inference, including the skill of the lawyers, the information they had available to them, the fact that they were particularly specifically warned by Perrigo that if you file this, it will be a sham, it will be a sham lawsuit. The fact that they were people who would have known that there were billions of dollars at stake, and that generics would threaten those billions of dollars.
The fact that the predecessor in interest chose not to file.
Yes, that's also a very important, the district court didn't rely on that, but
it was mentioned.
It's a very important fact. And of course, although the AbbVie lawyers were different, it was the same Besson's lawyer who was involved in the earlier lawsuit and the ones at issue here. It was the same guy, the only guy.
Correct evidentiary standard is for
these whether it's clear and convincing or so. I mean, we think that under Octane Fitness, the correct evidentiary standard is ordinary preponderance of the evidence, that there's no reason for a heightened standard here. But the court found that we met the heightened standard. I think that, you know, given the evidence the court had before it, that was correct. There's only one conclusion that can be drawn here, which is that the only reason for filing these objectively baseless lawsuits was to interfere with competition. You know, obviously, AbbVie and Besson's could have put on some evidence that they had some other intent. They chose not to do that. And the court had to draw an inference of intent from the objective evidence. There's nothing unusual with that. Courts do that all the time in antitrust cases, criminal cases, you know, you name it. You often have to try to discern someone's intent from their actions, and the court did that here and found only one conclusion. So with that, unless the court has more questions.
I have one last kind of deeper question about clear and convincing, which is this. If I understand it correctly, this Knorr-Pennington doctrine starts
in the context of petitioning the government for redress. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, lobbying, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Now, odds of success on lobbying, I don't know what that is. Maybe it depends who you are, but I suspect that that's very, very low, that you want to go and lobby something. Nora Pennington then gets extended to not just petitioning government, but to filing lawsuit. It's the First Amendment that set the standard, not petitioning government or filing lawsuits. So shouldn't there be parity between when something is sham or something is done for an improper purpose, since it's the First Amendment really that drives it? It would be strange to say you have a 0.5% chance of getting this lobbying-based solution, but now in litigation, we're going to demand that you have, I'm just ballparking, a 15% chance or a 5% chance. So I guess my question is, should there be parity between the Nora Pennington standard when it comes to petitioning government and when it comes to filing litigation? And if so, it seems that so far the lower standard seems to be petitioning government.
So I think that there's no doctrinal reason that I'm aware of why the standard should be different for petitioning activity and the government.
Because that comes from the First Amendment.
That's not the First Amendment. Yeah. I think, you know, under PRE, which, you know, applies to both litigation and petitioning as I read it, you know, the court's clearly concerned with the First Amendment, and that's why it imposed the subjectively baseless standard, which says, under the PRE standard, you can file a lawsuit to interfere with competition as long as you have a reasonable basis for doing, as long as you have an objectively reasonable basis for doing so. Where you get into a problem is where you file a objectively baseless lawsuit, because that's not really something that I think the First Amendment should protect. I mean, you know, it certainly protects people's access to the courts, their right to go and get relief, but for legitimate claims, not for baseless claims that are brought to interfere with competition.
Okay, so I'll end this with just one follow-up. If instead of filing these sham litigations in court, the patent holders went instead to Congress and said, on the basis of everything we've got here, we'd like you to make some amendments to the rules and give us a 30 months just for us and maybe make a private letter ruling or whatever redress we could get. Would that be objectively and subjectively baseless?
I'm not prepared to say what their odds of succeeding in Congress would be. I mean, you know,
the First Amendment dictates. But if at one level, if it's the First Amendment that provides the standard, it would have to be objectively and baseless for maybe both.
I mean, it's an interesting argument, but I mean, in courts we follow rules and we try to stick to them. I'm sure this court is well aware. In Congress, you know,
apparently not the red light rule.
In Congress, all bets are off. They can do whatever they want. So I'd be very hard-pressed to say that, you know, lobbying Congress is objectively baseless. There could be circumstances. I'm just not prepared to address that here today. Thank you for your time, Your Honors. We'd ask that the reverse payment claim be reinstated and the case remanded on the issues we've identified and then otherwise be affirmed.
I have one more question for you.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Back to disgorgement for a minute. Not 13B and all, but assuming that the disgorgement is a proper remedy, can you address the Besson's argument that none of it should have been allocated to them because they didn't receive any revenues from these sales?
Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is that under the way that the courts have addressed, including this court in the SEC context, have addressed equitable monetary relief and a look at Hughes Capital, the question focuses on, and by the way, this court clearly has addressed, found monetary relief appropriate under the SEC statutes, which have essentially the same language as the FTC Act. The court focuses on, would they jointly liable for the conduct? In this case, the sham litigation required both parties; neither could sue without the other's consent. The court could have said, all the money went to AbbVie in the first instance, so I'm going to let I'm going to impose all the liability on AbbVie, and then AbbVie and Besson can fight among themselves of who should bear that responsibility. But Besson said, why don't you hold us separately liable for our equitable share, and the court agreed to do that. I think it was just sort of short-circuiting this, and that was something that the court was able to do in the equitable.
It's an estoppel argument, right. Essentially. They said they invited that remedy.
I think they did invite it, and in any event, it's clearly something that is within the court's discretion to do under Hughes Capital. This may invite Mr. Knepel to get up and make a few points. So,
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. With that, we're going to invite counsel for Bessons to respond first. To that issue, please enter your name on the record. We don't have you in the minutes, so spell your name, if you would, for us.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Knepel, N-E-P-P-L, and I represent Bessons Healthcare, Inc. BHI, Bessons Healthcare, Inc., or BHI, makes two arguments unique to BHI. These are arguments over and above the arguments made by Abby, which we join. I will only address the second issue with respect to disgorgement. I think the first issue with respect to subjective baselessness is very straightforward and without nuance. We make the additional argument that disgorgement against BHI is punitive because BHI never received, held, or controlled any of the alleged ill-gotten gains that the lower court ordered it to disgorge. Royalties on the sale of Androgel were received by European subsidiaries of Bessons Healthcare SA, the corporate parent of BHI. FTC stipulated to these facts on the eve of trial. These are uncontested facts, and I would point the court to DX 304. This all matters because disgorgement upon BHI exceeds any gain to BHI and puts BHI in a worse off position than it would have been under the status quo or the but-for world. The Supreme Court in Kokesh viewed that type of outcome that puts the defendant in a worse off place as punitive. And as we know from this court's decision in TO in 2014, disgorgement may not be imposed punitively. So the punitive arguments made by Abby are only worse with respect to BHI because we never received, held, or controlled the monies that the lower court ordered disgorged. Now, with respect to the joint liability question, the lower court here apportioned the disgorgement between Abby and BHI. And yes, BHI did ask for that treatment. But that treatment was proper, if not required, by this court's decision in SEC versus Hughes, 1997. And there's no reason to upset that lower court determination that apportionment was appropriate. And with that, I will close.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Last but not least, based on my
stuff here.
Yes, Mr. Hoffman, retrieve your attorney-client privilege material there. And based on my rough calculation, the parties have had essentially equal time, and because all good things must come to an end, Mr. Waxman, I'm going to hold you to the 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'm confident that I'm hopeful that I won't even call upon your patience for that long. I have 2 points to make with respect to the monetary relief, and I think 3 points with respect to objective baselessness. With respect to monetary relief, the question of whether, or relief, period, whether disgorgement would be available even if there were a substantive violation for sham litigation or for a reverse payment, or whether an injunction would be available, turns on whether all of the elements of an antitrust violation are proven, one of which is antitrust injury. And the district judge, there's this argument that, well, we didn't have discovery. There was a full discovery and a full trial about what Teva would have done in the but-for world. And what the court found was that even, forget the settlement, even if no lawsuit had ever been filed, Teva never would have entered. That obviates the question of, that answers the question of whether there was any antitrust injury in this case. As to objective baselessness, we've heard another long discussion
trying to distinguish this thing or the other or what Teva might, what AbbVie might or might not have done. There was no talk about objective baselessness. And what happened, if you look at Judge Bartle's opinion and his summary judgment on objective baselessness, he spends 30 pages talking about the prosecution history, never mentioning any of the four cases that we cited as establishing that we were right on this issue, not just reasonable. And after 30 pages, he says, I find that AbbVie and Bessons haven't carried their burden in proving that prosecution history estoppel isn't a bar. And the very next page, in the very next paragraph, he says, therefore, no reasonable person could have, can come to that conclusion. That, in the absence of any discussion about all the case law that we cited in which the Federal Circuit found that, in fact, claims very similar, we can argue forever about whether they're controlling or not, were, you know, were correct or not. It's just he clearly, with all due respect to a very experienced and appropriately well-respected judge, Homer nodded here. He equated our burden to prove that we would have prevailed against a prosecution estoppel defense to a conclusion that no lawyer could objectively have believed that we might have. Now, as to the specific argument about, Judge Hardiman, you're absolutely correct that there is a patent law problem with what's called negative claiming, all penetration enhancers except oleic acid. That runs into all sorts of issues. My friend on the other side says, well, there's a black letter rule on tangentiality here that the Federal Circuit adheres to. First of all, as we pointed out, the Federal Circuit has made clear over and over and over again, as the Supreme Court did in Festo, that in this area, these are all equitable doctrines. There are no black letter rules. But his argument is that if the claimed equivalent is named in the prior art as a matter of black letter, it can't be tangential. That is true with respect to the prior art being avoided. If we had come up with an amendment that named oleic acid, it couldn't have been tangential to the patentability objection. The notion, as counsel has conceded, the notion that because isopropyl palmitate was mentioned in Allen means that it can't possibly be tangential is refuted by the fact that isopropyl myristate is also mentioned in Allen. And I know Your Honor, is Judge Phipps at least, is familiar with the relevant pages. If you look at page 1037 and 1038, you will see that they are not seeking to overcome Allen. There is page after page of argument about why Allen doesn't make it obvious to use one of those penetration enhancers with respect in testosterone composition because they are incredibly different, and Mack, in fact, teaches away from it. The notion that we also argued secondary considerations, that was also true in Eli Lilly. The notion that we identified specific concentrations of isopropyl myristate, number one, was not in rejection, not in response to any communication, and the concentrations that we identified are within the concentrations included in the prior art. So the level of concentration couldn't possibly be a way to avoid the prior art. And Judge Hardiman, finally, with respect to your observation about what Salve did in response to Perrigo's earlier effort to come in, first of all, that was different lawyers. It was a different formulation. And that what Salve's lawyers said is, we aren't going to do this at this time. The judge was entirely correct in not drawing an inference about what different lawyers, in response to a different generic formulation, did or did not think. I have argued in our brief and before this court that we are right on the infringement point. I don't think that I have committed a rule violation by saying either I'm covered by existing law or I'm asking for a reasonable extension to existing law, which is the standard both under PRE and in Rule 11. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel for all parties. A lot to think about. My unless there's objection, I'm thinking 2 weeks to file supplemental briefs on the jurisdictional question. Without objection. And I'm just going to throw this out there. I'm not saying you need to talk about this, but this whole issue of arising under is something that I think there's a lot of case law out there in the bankruptcy context, because as you may be aware, 1334B talk about arising under, arising in, and related to. And there is a lot of case law about what those phrases mean. Maybe that case law by analogy will be helpful to what arising under means in this case. Maybe it won't be. But I throw out there for your consideration the notion that there are two sides to this. Not only what does it mean to involve an important issue of patent law, but also what the phrase arising under means. So we'll issue a formal order on this, but we'll give you 2 weeks to brief that, and we'll put in a reasonable page limit, I think.
Send us a 28-J on the leave, too, after. No, it won't be touched.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and there's a chance we'll have to talk about whether to hold the case pending lieu or not. I have no idea whether that would be proper, but as you know, from time to time when there's a pending Supreme Court case that might bear on this one, sometimes the panel will wait to see what the High Court says. But
does the court want us to address that issue as well in our supplemental brief?
The lieu issue?
Whether the court should wait for lieu?
I
mean, we won't hear arguments until early March and the decision until June, so I don't know what you would have to say about it.
My preference, Your Honor, would be to wait and see what the Supreme Court says.
There's a fair chance that if we decide we have jurisdiction, we won't be publishing an opinion by June. So we'd welcome your 28Js at that point.
We have actually already addressed this.
Yeah.
We have a 28J, but I think if the Supreme Court issues a decision in lieu, it may well require some more detailed briefing.
Right. Maybe not.
I have a hunch that one side or the other, one side will say this is critically important, the other side will say, no, it's not. I don't know which one that would be.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you for the, we don't thank you for the size of the record, but we certainly thank you for the excellent briefing and argument, and take a 5-minute recess before the next argument.